I invite you to turn to Job chapter 11. Let me get our slides up here. So we're going to turn the page, obviously, to a new chapter. And in this particular chapter, we are now introduced to our third friend of Job, as he is, these guys are typically referred to. Oftentimes, when anybody's speaking about these friends, they offer up the famous air quotes of friends, as we've noted, and some of the counsel that has been offered up to Job from Eliphaz and Bildad, which, by the way, I would encourage any of you who are expecting children to go ahead and consider these three names just for fun. I don't know. At least get them on the list to kind of toss around a little bit between you as you're making decisions. But no, these three guys obviously they start off in the narrative as faithful friends traveling from various distances and coming with a real heart to mourn with Job and share in his pain and really just sit with him in silence, actually, for a full week. But then as the counsel unfolds, we just have noted over and over again that what is really what we're really observing, not just with these three friends, but also with Job, what we've just identified as a theological crisis that they're encountering as a result of what's taking place with Job and the ways in which these three friends are trying to interpret and understand and then thereby counsel Job. It's coming out of some very misunderstood theological presuppositions about the justice of God. And we talked about how this is really defined by this retribution principle, and this is just one way to define it from a particular scholar. The retribution principle is the conviction that the righteous will prosper and the wicked will suffer, both in proportion to their respective righteousness and wickedness. And so it stands to reason that Job is suffering. In fact, Job is suffering in such a way that it's hard to imagine if you believe that God's justice is more accurately defined by this retribution principle. It's hard to believe that he is not guilty of egregious sin. The extent, the type, the excruciating nature of his suffering and affliction, both visible in his physical body, but also the fact that he lost his family, he lost his well-being, his sustenance, his provision, his wealth, and he lost his influence, his reputation. By all appearances, Job is among the most guilty of some meaningful measure of ongoing wickedness. In fact, it would stand to reason that if this is your particular foundation for understanding how God's justice works in the affairs of men, that Job might have been a fraud all along and that really he was just sort of buying time until the actual punishment and justice of God was brought to bear for the actual character of this man. And so you have these sources of counsel in these three friends that are really informed by their understanding, or we might say their misunderstanding, of God's justice in a very retributive form, in that it's just proportional and direct and really immediate with sin. And so the blessed are the righteous are blessed, the wicked are cursed. And so if you see someone who is enjoying the favor, the apparent favor of God in the form of material blessings or family well-being or physical health or some combination of all those things, then clearly that is a righteous person. And if you see someone who is sort of walking through protracted seasons of trial and suffering, then clearly there is wickedness afoot. And so that's what the council is imbibing. That's what their whole framework is based upon. And we've also talked about how that's Job's framework as well. This is common, a common way of thinking about the gods, if you will, and the way that gods meted out justice amongst the affairs of men in the ancient times. And so it stands to reason that this would be their sort of understanding as well. And we've looked at these three men, really the first two, and we tried to kind of identify a certain profile of counsel that would help us maybe to either think more carefully about our counsel and our discipleship engagement with fellow believers, but also we've looked at Job and how he's responded to it and tried to draw principles from Job that might help us be more faithful and more Christ-honoring in our perseverance through trials and even in our response to counsel. So we tried to kind of draw out all these various principles through observation of this narrative, and we come today to the third friend who we have not heard from yet, and that is Zophar. And as I was reading through this and thinking about how to approach this particular chapter and really this particular friend of Job and his opening remarks to Job, I couldn't help but think about my own life and even thinking about a particular season of time when I was much younger. It was a season in which I was actually serving at that time on a church in Texas in a sort of a college and single adult ministry kind of role. And it was also during that time where I was going through my own sort of theological crisis of sorts. And I was grappling with the things that I was reading in Scripture versus the way that I saw ministry playing out before me in the life of the church. And I it seemed to me that those who were older than me and clearly wiser than me and much more experienced than me, in some ways were operating according to what, at least at the time, I thought was some kind of diminished view and understanding of who God was. And then, at that stage of life and in that age, the best worst thing happened, and that is I got a hold of some R.C. Sproul material, and I began to read, for example, The Holiness of God, and then I began to read Chosen by God, and I began to get my eyes open to the sovereignty of God and the majesty of God and the holiness of God and the bigness of God. And I was in an environment where I just felt like we were ministering and thinking and speaking and even praying in ways that would indicate that God was not that big after all, that God was not that powerful after all, that God was not that sovereign after all. And in my youth and immaturity, that incensed me. I was personally offended by all of this. And if I thought back, if I could even remember, which would be a long putt for me to remember the details, but if I could remember certain, you know, conversations or maybe reactions, I know that I would look back and I would feel a deep sense of shame in my conduct and my attitudes during that time. Because I, at that time, I think clearly I was struggling not just with a desire to understand who God was rightly and then to honor him appropriately in my life and in ministry and in the life of the church, but I was grappling with spiritual pride. And I think that that's the profile that we see here when we look at Zophar. We see this profile of spiritual pride, and we see, I think, four observations from his counsel that point to that. The first one is there on your screen, self-righteous retribution versus self-aware restoration. Let me just read the entire chapter for us, and then we'll kind of dive into these four observations that really, I think, highlight this really spiritual pride that is really devastating in the context of ministry and counseling and even faithful fellowship with one another as we seek to bear one another's burdens. In chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Then Zophar, the Naamathite, answered and said, 'Should a multitude of words go unanswered, and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men when you mock? Shall no one shame you? For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol. What can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes through and imprisons and summons the court, who can turn him back? For he knows worthless men. When he sees iniquity, will he not consider it? But a stupid man will get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. If you prepare your heart, You will stretch out your hands toward him. If iniquity is in your hand, put it far away and let not injustice dwell in your tents. Surely then you will lift up your face without blemish. You will be secure and will not fear. You will forget your misery. You will remember it as waters that have passed away. And your life will be brighter than the noonday. Its darkness will be like the morning. And you will feel secure because there is hope. You will look around and take your rest in security. You will lie down and none will make you afraid. Many will court your favor, but the eyes of the wicked will fail. All way of escape will be lost to them, and their hope is to breathe their last. This, as I said, I believe is a man who is exhibiting a very particular form of spiritual pride. And of course, we all grapple with, struggle with pride in some sort and in some manifestations. Through the course of our lives, it is the plight of man in his flesh until we are redeemed fully and made fully righteous in every way before Christ. But this form of pride is of a particular pointed nature. It is the kind of pride that really is a stomach-turning kind of pride, because it clothes itself in righteousness. It clothes itself in a superior form of godliness and wisdom. And I think that in the first section here, this is what we see as one of these characteristics of this profile of spiritual pride in Zophar. We see self-righteous retribution versus self-aware restoration. If you note verses 2 through 4, he says, "For as you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes." Actually, let me back up, starting in verse 2. I got ahead of myself there. Starting in verse 2, he says, "Should a multitude of words go unanswered, and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men, and when you mock, shall no one shame you? For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes." As soon as Zophar opens his mouth here, it becomes quite clear what his objective is. He makes it very plain there. He is filled with self-righteous indignation toward Job, and he sees Job not as a brother who is in invisible anguish and who really needs to be comforted. Rather, he sees Job as a babbling mocker. He sees Job as someone who needs to be shamed. Now, let's just recall for a moment Job's most recent statements that are eliciting this response from Zophar. These statements at the end of chapter 10 paint a vivid picture of the extent of Job's current state of despair. In Job 10, 18 to 20, he says this, praying and lamenting to God, "Why did you bring me out from the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me, and were as though I had not been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Then cease and leave me alone that I might find a little cheer. Before I go, and I shall not return, to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of gloom like thick darkness, like deep shadow without any order, where light is as thick as darkness." To this, Zophar responds with an indignant agenda to mock and shame Job. And notice what provokes Zophar. When you see this in verse 4, "For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes." Zophar picks out one little phrase in Job's entire response and lament, which had to do with Job grappling with this retribution principle, this retribution understanding of God's justice, namely, that he is suffering as though he is fraught with sin and wickedness, and yet as he examines his own heart and mind and life, he can't see anything there that would compel this kind of judgment from God, and he's lamenting the fact that he is innocent before God. And this is what provokes Zophar. How dare you? So Job's anguish, his expressions of lament, his crying out that he should never have been born, and his desire would be to just return to deep darkness, this despairing of soul has no effect on Zophar whatsoever. He is so fraught with a self-righteousness that any statement that might call into question his understanding of his theology and his knowledge of God is an affront to him that must be responded to. This is the tell. This reveals Zophar's spiritual pride and the self-righteousness that, in his way of thinking, demands some form of retribution against Job. Furthermore, if you look at this, you see that Zophar's pride, it blinds him. He's blinded to his own statements, to the meaning of his own intent here. He totally lacks a kind of self-awareness that it might have bent his counsel more toward a restorative intent, a comforting kind of intent. This brother who's anguishing, who has all the physical marks of pain and suffering with these sores all over his body. I mean, you couldn't have it be more obvious that someone's in pain. Not just the expressions of Job's lament and his painful heart, but the fact that his body is covered in infectious sores. And Zophar can't even see that what he's about to do makes him completely lacking in a kind of self-awareness that if it were in place, it might tailor his words more carefully. Listen to what he says again in verse 2 and 3. Should a multitude of words go unanswered and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men? And when you mock, shall no one shame you? Now, he's talking about a multitude of words going unanswered, but what has been happening this whole time? Job's words have been answered. This is the third response to Job. In fact, Zophar is the last in line. So if there's a question, if someone's saying, is anyone ever going to answer Job? Job could honestly say, get in line, Zophar. Get in line. You're late to the party. And yet here's Zophar sort of in his indignation saying, is anybody going to answer this man? That's all that's been taking place as these three men have come after him. And by the way, he says there that, is anyone going to answer him, or a man full of talk? Is he going to be judged right? And here's the irony of it. None of them are judging him right. None of them. And of course, according to Zophar, Job's babble, he says, should not be able to silence men. And his mockery, he says, should not be able to avoid a good and proper shaming that he's due. And in fact, what's about to happen is Zophar is going to seek to silence Job and shame Job through mockery. He completely lacks self-awareness to even see that he is about to engage in the very thing that he claims Job should be entitled to. That Job should not get away with. That he's going to do the very thing that he thinks Job should not be able to get away with. His mockery is really pointed, and we'll look at that a little more closely in just a moment. But if you see verse 12, he says, a stupid man will get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. This is mockery. He's basically pointing out that a stupid man is never going to get understanding. The likelihood of that is the same likelihood as a wild donkey's colt being born a man. He's actually employing mocking language and tone to shame Job in his stupidity, contesting that he is innocent. How stupid do you have to be, Job? Look at you. Look at the sores on you. Your children are gone. Your wealth is gone. Look at you. Obviously, you'll never get understanding if you persist in that kind of lunacy. He's indignant, and he's self-righteous, and he's completely lacking in a self-awareness that would temper one's counsel, that would cause one to kind of go, wait, hang on a second. The last thing I want to do is be guilty of the very thing that I'm incensed about right now. Charles Spurgeon says, "None are more unjust in their judgments of others than those who have a high opinion of themselves." I'm going to say that again. None are more unjust in their judgments of others than those who have a high opinion of themselves. And this is Zophar. He doesn't just have a strong conviction about his understanding of the justice of God. He has a very high opinion of himself, and therefore his judgments are acutely severe and harsh. No self-awareness to temper this self-righteous bent toward retribution rather than restoration, rather than seeking to comfort Job. Did you hear what he just said, Zophar? He's feeling darkness just surround him. He's longing for darkness to encompass him. And you think that what is needed here is retribution in your self-righteous pride. Well, another thing I think we see from Zophar in this profile of spiritual pride is a foolish confidence versus a fearful reflection. You see this in verses 5 to 6. He says, "But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you." Do you hear that? "But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves." If God would just show up and stand side by side with me, he would attest to the fact that you are lacking in wisdom. And in fact, the suffering that you're enduring right now isn't even enough to comport with what you actually deserve. That's foolish confidence in your clarity about what God thinks about another person in their trial. That does not look like a man who actually fears the Lord. That looks like a man who is rushing in with a self-righteous pride and confidence, who would so cavalierly invoke the words of God to be uttered as his defender, as the one who would come and affirm his posture of self-righteousness and pride. That's bold. This is an alarming degree of foolish confidence, invoking God to weigh in on this matter because, you know, Zophar, certainly God will agree with him. But might I remind all of us of what God actually said about Job and about Job's current situation? Chapter 1, verse 8. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?'" Verse 12, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your hand, only against him do not stretch out your hand.'" You want to know what God thinks of Job? Do you want to know how God would describe Job's current circumstance? Well, there it is. And then again in chapter 2, verse 3, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason.'" This is God doubling down on his initial declaration of Job's righteousness before Satan himself. And then in verse 6 of chapter 2, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. You want to know why Job lost everything, including his family? You want to know why Job is covered in sores? You want to know what God thinks about Job and his character and his integrity and how God would describe the scenario that, Job finds himself in? Well, there it is. Zophar, are you sure? Are you sure you want God to show up and speak to this matter? Zophar couldn't have been more wrong, right? He couldn't have been more wrong about God's opinion of Job and God's ultimate purposes in Job's suffering. We might look at this and we might be tempted to say, well, how could Zophar couldn't have known that? I mean, we have the privilege of reading the narrative now. But Job could not have known that. But isn't that the point? The point of emphasis here is what what Zophar could not claim to know, and yet is claiming to know. It's not the fact that Zophar didn't have the privilege of observing this divine counsel in which these declarations from God to Satan were made. It's the fact that he presumes to know too much. He presumes to know too much about what God would say or what God would think about Job or these matters. He's speaking from this lofty posture of spiritual pride, of self-righteousness. And he has this bold confidence that surely God would agree. If God were to speak, he would vote for me. There's no fear of the Lord in that kind of statement, in that kind of disposition. There's no desire to demonstrate any kind of fearful reflection. In fact, all the counselors could have used some of that. No one, including Zophar, certainly Zophar, no one is saying, might Job be right about something? Might there be something going on here that I can't be so confident about? I'm not even referring to the fact that Zophar should have had crystal clarity about everything. Just fearful reflection. Not bold confidence in invoking God's presence in that response to Job to lambast him. If, as Proverbs actually teaches us, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and the beginning of knowledge, should that not give us pause when we think we are certain about what God thinks right now in this moment? It's the fear of the Lord that's the beginning of the wisdom, not my self-righteous proclamations about what I know God is thinking. And that fear compels humility. It compels caution, not rushing in, not speaking with bold, presumptuous confidence. And Zophar is lacking this. It is a dreadful place to be when we confidently believe we know God in ways that we actually don't. That is a very, very dreadful place for us to be. C.S. Lewis says, as long as you are proud, you cannot know God. A proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see something that is above you. This is not just about getting something wrong, it's about getting God wrong. And proudly so. Foolish confidence versus fearful reflection. Well, the third characteristic in this profile is weaponized mystery versus worshipful sympathy. Weaponized mystery versus worshipful sympathy. Look at verses 7 to 12. Can you find out the deep things of God, Zophar says? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol. What can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes through and imprisons and summons the court, who can turn him back? For he knows worthless men when he sees iniquity, will he not consider it? But a stupid man will get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. You have Zophar sort of engaging in what you could characterize as elevated rhetoric, describing the immeasurable depths of God's wisdom and his ways. But he's not expressing in these lofty terms about God and his ways and his wisdom and the mystery of God. He's not expressing this as a means of elevating Job's spirits, nor of sympathizing with Job in his clear confusion and pain. Rather, he's using this as a means of piercing Job with these condemning insults and this mockery. He's basically articulating what could be the beginning of a hymn of praise to God. You could take what Zophar is saying here and you could lay it next to any number of psalms and you would see some symmetry there. You would see common language. This could be the beginning of a worship hymn. But he's not speaking these things, these wonderful things about the mysterious, wise, powerful, almighty God to draw Job into the presence of this God who can bring about all comfort in worship. He's using this to then come back around and pierce Job with insults and mockery. This is alarming, to put it mildly. This is a case in which you have a man who is so consumed with spiritual pride, with a form of self-righteousness, that he is so cavalier previously with invoking the presence of God to speak on his behalf, now in articulating worshipful rhetoric and prose that would typically compel other people to join in an amen chorus, but he's weaponized it. That's a consuming kind of spiritual pride. It is the kind of pride that is nauseating to witness. That any of us at any point in time would try to leverage what we think is our clarity and our understanding and our ability to articulate and pontificate upon the glory of God, the majesty of God, the works of God, the doctrines of God, and then turn and use that knowledge and that capacity for articulation to pierce someone who is already wounded. That's an alarming use of the tongue that God gave us, of the mind that God gave us. And that's what Zophar does here. It's a strong caution. We've been talking about this on a number of fronts, the danger of us coming in hot with our theological certainties and lacking in appropriate compassion for the pain that someone's experiencing. This reminder continues to intensify as we continue to move through this book. And I'm ready to stop my study right here in chapter 11. I can't handle the conviction anymore. Another quote, Jonathan Edwards says, "Christian humility, under a sense of others' misery, entreats and beseeches, but spiritual pride commands and warns with authority." This is the distinction. There is a place for entreating and beseeching even someone who is in the throes of anguish and suffering and pain. We are called to point people to what is true, to remind them of what is true, to draw them back to what is true. This is not about an either-or proposition, about us representing what is true to those who might be confused or perplexed or maybe even thinking in ways that are not in accord with the truth in the midst of their suffering. But we're called to do that with gentleness and patience and endurance. Not out of a defensiveness because our pride is being assaulted. Because our defense of good and sound doctrine is under assault. I have to be reminded of these things. I love that these quotes, particularly Spurgeon and Edwards, I mean, these are coming from some stout theological minds. They're calling us to a kind of humility, a kind of patience that, yes, entreats and beseeches, but does not load the counsel to the suffering with spiritual pride that just takes the form of commands with authority. Get your mind right. How could you think such things if you're a believer? What's gotten into you? You know that's not what God is like. God is like this, not like that. You're acting as though God is like that and not like this. This is the Zophar profile of counsel that we need to try to avoid. And then finally, this is the last one. We'll be quick with this one. You have this prioritized relief versus persevering faithfulness. You see this in verses 13 to 20. If you prepare your heart, you will stretch out your hands toward him. If iniquity is in your hand, put it far away and let not injustice dwell in your tents. Surely then you will lift up your face without blemish. You will be secure and will not fear. You will forget your misery. You will remember it as waters that have passed away. And your life will be brighter than the noonday. Its darkness will be like the morning. And you will feel secure because there is hope. You will look around and take your rest in security. You will lie down and none will make you afraid. Many will court your favor. Now I would just ask a rhetorical question. Is that good counsel to offer up to someone who is in the throes of suffering? Just do this and all of this will ensue. It's just that simple. And we know, of course, even in our study here and certainly in our study in 1 Peter with Pastor Shane, that we are called. It is appointed to us that we suffer in this life. But those who are covered up in spiritual pride, if they're in the midst of a counseling session, a counseling relationship, a discipleship relationship with someone who is going through a season of intense anguish and profound confusion about their life, about God's works and ways, about God's purposes, deep anguish, profound confusion, long-standing despair, they're walking through this, and the spiritual pride of a counselor comes along, and what are they going to be most interested in? A winning transaction to make them feel good about their counsel. They're going to want to see results. I will tell you these wise things. I will offer you these profound insights. And if you will just listen to me, then all will be well. And I'll feel great about how wise I am. And we know that that's not how life works. We know that that's not what the gospel calls us to. We know that that's not at all what Jesus promised his faithful disciples. And yet here's a man who in his counsel, and really sort of shaped by this retribution understanding of God's justice in no small measure, but his focus is to prioritize the transactional relief that will come if Job will just merely agree with him. Just merely agree that, yes, you're full of sin. That's the only thing that could explain where you are. So just agree, turn toward me, and what I'm saying, and then you will experience the manifold blessings of God in this life, mind you. it will be obvious so that we can all point to it and go, look what I did. Can you hear it? Can you hear the conversation? Yeah, I was counseling him for a long, long time, and he finally did what I told him to do, and look what happened. Look at that. He got all his stuff back. Look at that. This is what spiritual pride can do. I would venture a guess that most of you have not just experienced it by observation, but you've experienced it by your own actions and thoughts at some season of time in your life. And we can easily become absorbed in a form of spiritual pride that renders us utterly ineffective in our counsel to those who are suffering. And it ultimately puts a wedge between us and genuine fellowship with the God that we so proudly claim to know so well. May God help us to avoid such a place. Let's pray.